whatever they want to pay for it.
Yeah, I know. We'll call the meeting of the Senate Interim Committee on Business and Transportation to order. For the record, it's January 11th, 2018. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're going to, we have lined up for you today two informational meetings. First one will have three panelists in the room and one on the phone. It's on the Oregon Green Energy Fund concept. The second one will be on impacts of emerging technologies on land use, transportation, urban design, and real estate. Both those will be followed by then our work session where we will be getting a quick overview of it. The committee will be taking the chance to vote on whether to introduce three committee bill concepts, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. So, who's first?
I believe we have Judge Pete Runnels, Neil Sakon, Lori Cheek here in the room, and then at the appropriate time, I'll be calling Brian Young from the Washington Department of Commerce.
Great. Well, welcome.
Thank you.
Sorry to keep you waiting.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Thompson, and all the senators on the committee, thank you for your time and listening to us today. I'm Pete Runnels, Harney County Judge, County, of course, that's a member of AOC. Bring you greetings from Burns, Oregon, and want to share with you a project that we have in place and working. It's been a huge success for our area, and with it, had there been an energy investment fund, a green energy, it could have been a lot much more simpler for us. We had a lot of cooperation, and hats off to Meyer Memorial Trust for helping us with this project, staying behind us, and seeing. We created a district heating source that is heating our elementary school, our courthouse, one business, our mental health facility, and we have a church coming online and our jail coming online this summer. We are burning biomass from the forest, unending supply, clean energy, and results for the courthouse alone are over 50% savings in our heating costs. We take care of our needs out there when we have a problem. The school's heating system was basically shot and gone. The courthouse, we were on our last year. It had been it was decommissioned. We had 1 year to use it. We had to come up with a project. So working closely together and with the developer, we came upon this source and this project. He went to Austria for the technology. Technology is from Austria. It came to us from Austria. And has just been a wonderful thing. We want to expand. We're hoping to expand into we're looking at a lift project. We want to expand into that, heat those units with this. And it's important to know that we have no natural gas in our county, several counties that way. This is our natural gas. We've had issue of, before this happened, we got things going in the school. We had kids going to school, keeping their jackets on and gloves. So we could go to the failing system there. So with this type of fund, it could have helped us. We found our way through, but it could help so many more. And this could be replicated simply in other areas. With that, I'll pass the
mic. Thank you, Judge.
Morning. My name is Neil Sakon. I'm with Sky Blue Center Community Development. We consult with economic community development groups throughout the Pacific Northwest. I'm an attorney by training, occasionally by trade. We have some graphics that in the picture's worth a thousand words category. It might be helpful to get those.
Someone coming up.
Okay. Well, let me get started. What the judge is really referring to is an example of economic development. I think we're all familiar these days with buzzwords, green energy, clean energy, you know, and whatnot. But in a lot of ways, we're just talking about a new kind of widget. And these widgets, whether they're being manufactured locally or just installed locally, have really large impacts in rural areas, in urban areas, in Harney County, in Multnomah County. And if you're talking about economic development, you're talking about how to finance where's your capital coming from? You can't have economic development without a source of capital. If you've got a round widget and you go to the local bank and you say, I have a round widget, can you help me finance the manufacturing facility? They'll say, sure, we can finance a round widget. If you're going to the local bank with a new square widget, which everyone agrees is great, it's green, everyone wants to see green widgets, the local loan officer might say, you know, we like the color, but we don't like the shape. We can't finance square widgets. There's no way we can pound that into our underwriting models. And that is a huge problem with emerging nascent technologies. So where does the money come from? There's been a lot of models proposed over the years. Programmatically and from a policy standpoint, it's a traditional role of the government to set the tone, set the pace, set the objectives. Say, well, you know, we think from the standpoint of the general public and the public fisc, there ought to be development in these certain areas, whether it's trying to figure out how to finance an energy production facility that supports courthouses and schools in Harney County, or the installation of rooftop solar to help homeowners reduce the carrying costs of their homes. It really doesn't matter. It's a policy objective. Way back in the early days, this goes back to the 50s and 60s, the government got into the lending business. There's still artifacts of that out there. They're cumbersome. They're lugubrious. They have lots of regulations. As an attorney, I've paid for part of the pool dealing with some of those kinds of programs. But over the last, I'd say, 20, 25 years, there's been other methods that have been developed to get to the same kind of programmatic objectives while keeping public agencies, private sector funders, and project developers within their swim lanes. And that's really the key to what we're proposing this morning in terms of the so-called clean energy investment fund, which is a way to provide funding throughout the state of Oregon, whether it's rural, urban, interurban, to nascent projects, really the folks that are developing the green square widgets, because they just can't get financing other places. When you work in the economic development sector, as I'm sure some of you are aware, and I'll I'm working my way through my slides, so hopefully by the time I get this, the graphic that I need to show you, I'll be able to get to. Economic development people, those of you who have been in this niche will have heard capital stacking, toolkits, all those other kinds of buzzwords, and what they're really meaning to say is that when you're looking at nascent and emerging products and markets, you need an array of capital sources. And typically, money's not coming from a single source. It's not like financing your home, your car, or traditional business. So you're integrating sources. The timing, the underwriting, the general framework is all different. In many cases, excellent sources of funding, whether it be Business Oregon or USDA, they just can't do it. And it may not be, it could be a matter of timing. It could be at the end of their funding cycle. I mean, I've seen dozens and dozens of reasons why excellent projects go into the bin because they just can't get it together with the few funding sources that are out there. And the biggest advantage and the way to grease the rails most effectively is by maximizing the toolkit, so to speak. So, again, this morning, this proposal is really about providing more tools. It's not about taking items off of a plate at a commercial bank. It's not about taking items off of the plate at Business Oregon, for example, or competing with USDA. It's about providing more flexibility for more products. among the toolkits that have emerged in this kind of new perspective on the role of government, a couple of examples I'll draw from at the federal level, there's a, within Treasury, there's a Community Development Financial Institution Department, which has provided funding to CDFIs and CDEs, and the way they do it is they don't underwrite. They're managing objectives. They're saying, give us your metrics, we'll tell you what we want the program to be, and then we're going to line up your metrics with the program, and if you meet those objectives by demonstrable metrics, sort of evidence-based policy making, we'll provide you with funding. If you succeed, we'll give you an opportunity to demonstrate how you've succeeded. And if you fail, we're not giving you any more money. So it's a, it has really worked out to the tune of tens of billions of dollars. It's a model which has been applied in the housing sector. It's a model that's been applied in the economic sector. And now we're seeing this happening at a state level as well. So in Washington, which, as you know, is just north of us, Connecticut, New York, just to name a few examples. There's agencies that have been set up either as completely private sector approaches, such as in Washington, or quasi-public, where it's an agency which is directed by publicly appointed officials but is otherwise private sector. They're taking money from the public fisc, taxpayer dollars, they're allocating it to deployment agencies, and then those private sector deployment agencies are managing the risk. So they manage the portfolio, they source and originate, they use their underwriting guidelines to determine whether a project is going to, the likelihood of success or possibility of failure for a project, and then they report back to the funding source the outcomes and results, and then the funding sources, which is the government agency, can then make programmatic decisions about, do we want to adjust the program? We want to not allocate any more funds to this particular agency, and so on and so forth. It's been a very efficient method of managing public dollars to particular public sector goals and objectives. The advantage of using these private sector agencies, which typically are not commercial banks, although there are some commercial banks that through their CDFI programs do participate in non-traditional underwriting approaches. These are typically non-profit lenders, and we have a lot of them that operate nationally and also regionally. So national, NDC, and I'm a victim of acronyms. I'm not sure I can tell you what some of these stand for. LIF, NDC, Craft 3, Capital Impact, there's another group called Impact Capital. All of these are nonprofit groups that originate loans and manage portfolios. And those are the kind of project partners that we're talking about for this program. So what would happen is the government would make policy program decisions. It would provide funding to this to these private sector groups on a competitive allocation basis. So you would apply for the funds, you'd get the money, you would deploy it if you're the agency, you would manage the risk, manage the portfolio to make sure that you're lending to good projects and providing a considerable amount of technical assistance. I think the folks from Harney County can probably tell you that the road from the idea to the implementation,
it was tough.
It took a while.
It was tough.
Yeah.
It was fast, too, for us. You know.
But you probably needed help. You had your developer. You had your finance people that were helping to adjust, underwrite, and move things along.
Yes, and when we had an attorney.
Could I get you to put your name on the record, please?
I'm sorry. my name is Lori Cheek, and I work for the juvenile department in Harney County. I'm school board person in Harney County and Burns, and I am on the board for the co-op that we formed to do this high desert biomass. And I want you to know Craft 3 absolutely helped us to do this project.
Craft 3 was the lender in that particular case, and in my experience as an attorney and consultant at a project level, the role of these loan officers and these lenders,
They help you get it done.
So can a government agency do that as effectively as a private sector agency? From a technical standpoint, probably. Can they do it as effectively from a portfolio management standpoint? On the other side of the table, at Craft 3, they're looking at their loan portfolio and making sure that they want their money back.
So Craft, let me clarify, Craft 3 is a not-for-profit
correct.
Lender?
Correct.
Works with USDA quite a bit. USDA actually gave them a pool of money that the projects did not fit, but we didn't fit USDA because they wanted to build the project for us, and then we could do the financing through them. We built the project first, and that stopped us from being able to use that money. But that money that Craft 3 had from USDA for these odd projects that were very worthy of it, we were able to use through them. So that's worked very well.
Who did you work with at Craft 3?
Brad.
Brad Hunter?
Yes. Amazing, great guy.
So he's boots on the ground. I mean, again, all of these type of lenders, they've got folks, they found you or you found them.
Well, you know, we visited a bank in Portland that I think it's Continental Bank.
Yep.
And they told us about this, the Click-A-Tat project that they did where they had to put a whole new sewer system in up in Washington, mm-hmm. and they helped everybody get hooked up. They have a project where they will, so the homeowner has a boiler, wants to put hot water, but the hookup cost is very prohibitive, like putting in heat pumps from your electrical energy. They will carry that they will help them. They will help the
kind of bridge kind
their
of
bridge,
loan.
Yeah.
So that's a great example of, you know, where things can get stuck. Where in that particular case, it's sort of a retail homeowner level project, which is innovative. It's the round peg. It's not a square peg. You're not going to get financing for it from a traditional bank. So Craft 3 is able to come in and bridge to one of these other capital sources. So what I'm saying, capital, that's another example, kind of capital stacking, sequencing, having more tools and more ability to do that. The program we're proposing is to do just that. And then at the same time, Craft 3 has an extensive compliance group within the bank that creates metrics and reports for their funders, and a lot of their funding comes from government agencies. And they're able to provide metrics. We funded X boiler conversions, including loan losses. I mean, we originated 100 loans and 3 went bad. I mean, all these kinds of things become part of the knowledge base, so that if you're sitting in Salem as a policymaker or a program director, you sort of can look at dashboards, and you're remote to the risk. But you're managing the risk remotely, so that you've got these private sector banks that are in the banking and lending business doing the direct management, and you can then decide remotely whether they're doing what you want them to do. And then there's sort of knobs and dials. We can say, okay, well, we want to see more boiler conversion programs. So for next year, we're going to give more points to applicants who are going to fund more boiler conversion programs and so on and so forth. That's basically the model. You'll never see the graphic, apparently.
I will. Mr. Chair, if I may.
Yeah, you
so we do have your presentation on our OLA system, so it's visible to anybody with a computer. Senator Rada's in front of him. We're bringing copies down of the presentation so that you can, so that they'll have it in hard copy. We apologize for technical difficulties.
The one I want you to remember, if you can capture that image, is this is the graphic that would have helped. I like talking, so this has been great for me. The picture probably would have been better. But basically, you put policy risk. As legislators, senators, I'm sure you've all made decisions that you've come to regret later. I won't ask what those are, because I know what they are. But you manage that kind of risk, program and policy, and then let the private sector manage the actual economic and financial risks. And if they're not doing it correctly, don't give them any money. And you can do that on an annual, biennial basis. If they're doing it correctly, give them more money. Because what you end up with is these primary, secondary, and tertiary effects. There was an economic development officer in Klamath County who grew up in urban areas. I live in rural Washington now. But I was stunned at this statistic, and some of you may know this. The multiplier effect of creating one job, I think he said in Klamath compared to Portland, was like 140. I mean, if you create 10 jobs in a rural area, it's as if you created 1,400 jobs in Portland. So scale works both ways. And that also means that if you're providing a heat source to public facilities in burns, if you're providing capital to an emerging installer of boiler conversion systems, there's going to be other impacts. And that's getting back to the beginning of the presentation. When I'm talking about widgets, I think it's important conceptually to recognize that there's so many kinds of widgets you can do. Focus on boiler conversions. You can focus on a bunch of different projects, and services. They're all sort of important. The concept here isn't so much about that. Those are program decisions that you all can make later. The point this morning is really, how do you fund it? What are effective and efficient ways to do it? And this kind of public-private partnership approach has proven to be effective at a federal level. It's proving to be very effective at a state level as well.
So at the core, what we're talking about here is a lending program or a loan fund, if you will.
Correct.
That would be targeted in some way. This, I assume, the green is because we're focusing on emerging new technologies. So
correct.
Dedicated source and doing it by the legislature allocating a source of funding to private, not-for-profit lenders.
Correct, and you can define who that would be. One criteria could be only this group of non-profit community-based lending organizations. You can define it that way. There are commercial banks, again, that have departments that do the same thing. But that's a policy decision you could make at the outset. Is what's the filter going to be? Who's eligible for this funding?
Okay. So for us, the question would be, how does this fit into our overall policy in terms of, is this something that the legislature puts a priority on? And how does it fit, if it is, how does it fit within our overall lending programs that we operate through Business Oregon?
Correct.
Okay.
Yep. I mean, my advice is think about toolkits and capital stacks, because that's the reality on the street. It's business Oregon has done some great work, and we've also seen sort of program failures at the state level at the same time. This really isn't about either of those two things. It's really about how do you create an environment for local developers, local project managers, that gives them the most flexibility to put these things together, because they're not the square pegs, they're the round ones.
Yeah.
And at the same time, manage the risk so that if you're allocating taxpayer dollars, you're going to get the dollars back,
yeah,
either literally or conceptually through other economic benefits at a local level.
We do have a program that's somewhat similar to that in our capital access program, where the state, through Business Oregon, actually gives money to private banks to back loans,
mm-hmm,
to offer the guarantee to,
yep,
get them to do things that they otherwise couldn't do under their lending,
yep,
criteria.
Loan guarantee programs have been an extremely effective way to leverage funds. And that's about the risk management,
mm-hmm,
and the management of the risk is an important thing to think about. The resources, as you all know, it's a zero-sum game. So where are you going to put the money? And when you put money out there, how are you going to make sure that it does what you wanted it to do?
Right. Did you want to address it separately?
Yeah. I am. I'm going to kind of finish the program.
Please.
And
we do have a call in Washington State.
I think our order of business was to give a call to
Washington State Commerce Department. Has a program similar to what.
Okay,
we're
so
proposing.
We want to call.
So I think,
yeah, and then Lori's
going to
finish us off, so why don't I call?
Program.
We'll do it that way, then.
Yeah, especially if you're going to do the wrap-up, then.
All right.
We'll see how this works.
So this is Brian Young?
Correct.
That's about all we have available right now.
so far, so good.
Those are megawatts.
We're having a good luck with technology today. Hi, is this Brian Young?
This is.
Brian, this is Senator Lee Byer. I'm the chair of the Oregon Committee on Business and Transportation, and we have a discussion going on about a proposal for a green energy fund, and I understand that you're going to enlighten us about how Washington State does this.
I am, and thank you. I've been watching online, and Chairman and committee members appreciate you giving me some time to tell you a little bit about our clean energy fund here in Washington State, and I'd be happy to answer any questions afterwards.
Thank you.
So, we in Washington State, we have a clean energy fund. Its inception was in 2013. To date, we've put $76 million into that fund, and there's three main areas of investment: research, development, and demonstration grants, grid modernization grants to utilities. And the third program is the one I'll talk about today, the revolving loan grants to nonprofit lending institutions. So our revolving loan grant program has been funded to the tune of $25 million since 2013. And it's legislatively required to support the widespread use of proven building energy efficiency and renewable energy technologies now inhibited by a lack of access to capital for residential and commercial properties. So, as it says there, we've got two main focus areas in the $25 million of funds we've put out. We've got loan portfolios for building energy efficiency upgrades. Those go out from the whole range of buildings, from residential, multifamily, commercial, as well as even agriculture and industrial energy efficiency projects. We also have a commercial business loan program specifically for clean technology companies. I'll just give you a little bit about the nuts and bolts of our program as it exists, and then I'll go on to some of the benefits that we see in our state. So the way our clean energy fund is set up, all funds must be distributed through a competitive selection process. We have external boards of experts that grade those and make the determinations on those, on the proposals we receive. We allow the those putting in the proposals to define their target markets and approaches, so we're pretty hands-off, other than it has to be within clean technology, commercial loans, and energy efficiency upgrades. We're pretty hands-off on, we let the lenders and those who know the markets decide where they want to target. All funds, we require a minimum of one-to-one leverage in all the funds that we grant out. That being said, in the commercial business loan portfolios, we are expecting to see greater than 7-to-1 leverage. And in the building energy efficiency portfolios, we're expecting to see nearly 20-to-1 leverage. So we're feeling very good about the amount of leverage that the partners who've won these awards thus far are able to provide. The one-to-one leverage is just what's required by law. And just a little nuts and bolts again, successful bidders, the way it's set up, they draw down their funds in tranches. About one-third of the funds are given out in tranches throughout our two-year period. That we do this biannually, like our budgeting process. So once they pull down a third, they can come back and get their, assuming they've met all their parameters and whatnot, they get the next third and then the next third. Our partners manage all the loan underwriting and servicing of the loans. They absorb all the losses, and they're required to revolve those grant funds for a minimum of 10 years. We also expect that those funds will actually probably revolve for much longer than 10 years, but by contract, they have to revolve them for 10 years. Administratively, we are also, I'd say, fairly hands-off. We require monthly reporting of some of the metrics. I think one of the previous speakers mentioned, our partners are well-equipped already to provide all the metrics and all the reporting. They have lots of different reporting through their federal programs and whatnot, so we're probably not a very onerous reporting system for them. They do really when they come after they've won the award and they've given us our proposal. They've contracted what they said they do in their proposal. They just come back to us for each loan and just confirm that the loan that they're going to make fits in those parameters, what a, like a clean technology company is, or that project meets our parameters of clean technology. Administratively for the state, we keep our administrative fees at a 3% or below, so we take very little out of administration. So a little bit about our goals and kind of why it benefits the state of Washington and why it's been successful for us. And this has been a very successful program. The Clean Energy Fund in general has, and this program is acknowledged to be successful across the state. What we really see is just our partners, those third parties are the true experts in this field. They've been in business for a long time. They've run these portfolios. They know what they're doing. They provide the expertise and the due diligence. They insulate the state from losses. These are grants. We don't expect to see any of this money back. We've granted it out. And that we expect them to use them and run their business like they've been running their business in the case of our partners for many, many years. So, and then it also just insulates the state from the idea that maybe there's politicians somewhere or agency people who are choosing winners and losers out there. Again, we don't have any say on who gets the loans as long as they meet the lending parameters. Why we thought of this in the first place is that, as the previous speaker said, we've seen the need out there that traditional lenders were not addressing, basically due to their lack of familiarity with the clean tech sector. The green and square widgets was probably a pretty good acknowledgement of that. But we've addressed that need, and our program's been going on now since 2013, and we expect it to continue. But also, we're seeing other lenders also in the for-profit realm taking notice and starting to develop their own portfolios. And that's really what we wanted to do, is open this up to provide an example that there is a market out here for these kind of loans and these kind of technologies. So we're seeing that happen in Washington. We're happy with that. And also, it's for those entrepreneurs and those folks that both the entrepreneurs and our partners, our lending partners, that the entrepreneurs need the capital, and the partners are willing to take a little more risk than a lot of the traditional for-profit lenders were, and they've really spent their time and their energy learning about the unique challenges and the unique opportunities in the clean tech sector. So we feel over the past now 5 years that we've built a very strong foundation in this area, and we're happy to see it continue. A little bit about some of the portfolio metrics, and I'll talk mainly about the commercial business loan portfolio because it seems to be an area of interest. There's been $22.2 million clean energy fund money that's been lent out since the program's inception. Addition to that, there's an additional $10 million of non-clean energy fund money has gone into those projects. And the reason for that, a good example is the Timbers, one of our soccer teams, our minor league soccer teams. They were able to do a big retrofitting of their stadium, and the Clean Energy Fund was able to provide loans to get them new lighting, highly efficient LED-based lighting for their entire stadium. But at the same time, they also wanted to put new turf in and do upgrades to the stadium. So our funds could do the energy portion of that. But then there was another large fund, a large amount of money from the partner that went into the rest of that upgrade. So that's another place we're seeing leverage. We're seeing bigger projects happen because of that. And today we can directly attribute, created or protected or retained jobs, 337 jobs. And over 180,000 metric tons of greenhouse gases that have been avoided or sequestered. So those are some of the parameters that we, when I said we asked for some monthly reporting and then we have some quarterly parameters. There's greenhouse gas emissions. I don't know all of them off the top of my head, but greenhouse gas emissions, leverage, jobs created or retained. Or so that is very quickly, and hopefully you all can hear me well, but that's what I wanted to talk about, and I'd be happy to take any questions or provide more information on any of the projects.
Thank you, Brian.
Programs.
Committee, any questions? Guess not. Thank you very much. It's very informative.
Appreciate your time.
Very informative. And?
All right. You know, in hearing everybody has talked about a lot of, I want to thank you very much for letting us come up here. We're very proud of what we do in Burns, Oregon. And we've had a couple years of some pretty tough stuff. And I believe that it's made us stronger. And we are so happy to share a pretty big success that actually was grown there. So when I thought about, I want you to know that there was a great need in 2012. The school had a 74-year-old boiler that had to have its doors replaced, fabricated. Okay, that was $56,000. And it did not heat. It was an oil boiler. Did not heat. The controls were old. It was embarrassingly bad, to the point that pipes were breaking. We had a really cold winter that year. Mm-hmm. At the same time, the courthouse knew that they were going to need to replace their heating system, and they didn't have a cooling system, so their heating system was steam. I don't know if you've had an experience with old steam heaters. They're all on, or it's too hot, or it's too cold. There is really very little in between. And so that was happening at the same time. A young man came to talk to us about putting in pellet stoves in the boilers, which is a manufactured product. It's really good. It's used in a lot of homes. But it's what I call, because I came out of the woods industry, twice touched. It's a dried product, and it's manufactured, thereby increasing the cost. Plus, it would have to be hauled into our community because we don't have a pellet mill anymore. We used to. So we asked for hog fuel. This young man's name was Andrew Hayden. He has a business called Wisewood Energy. And he was a key component. There was a need. There was somebody that came and listened to us and said, I don't know what technology you want. I'm not getting hog fuel, chips, yard debris. Think electrical trimming trees. Those are things we can burn. We just grind it up. It's a 4 by 4 inches chip. It can have a moisture of 50%. The technology came out of Austria. It is a completely encompassing technology that burns its own smoke. It is completely different than anything that we've seen in the U.S., and I actually was the owner of a cogen at the mill, so I'm pretty familiar with making our own electricity. It takes much less. We only burn about 500 tons a year of what you would look at would be, if you guys are familiar with hog fuel, it's just stuff that would slash piles that would be burning up in the hills. Remember also we were replacing diesel, and diesel and gas are driven into our community. So there's a lot of changes in that. We didn't use huge amounts, the school did. The school used huge amounts of diesel. So we've got the need, we've got somebody that believed us. 2 years later, in 2014, he came back to us and he said, I found it. It's going to be spendy, and he was very excited about it. He is a true developer, very intelligent man. We thought we had it all funded through U.S. endowment. The school and the county were going to put up about $500,000 in accrued money to replace our heating. School had very little. County had some. And so who else joined with us was Meyer Memorial. They believed in this, and they have been right beside us the whole time. In 2014, August of 2014, our funding fell through. We also got tax credits, EIPs, that were supposed to be a 2-year payout. Meyer Memorial came in and funded that for us, and it was $500,000 at the same time as us putting in our $500,000. Our funding fell through because we were using the U.S. Endowment, and the U.S. Endowment had a change in how they were looking at that, and they stopped it. And it was horrendous for us because we were going. We were pulling the trigger, and we didn't know what we were going to do. Our community got together and did called everybody, USDA, senators, economic development, Forest Service, of course, Mr. Hayden, not Craft 3 at that time, but everybody that we could get together to talk about what do we do. And some of the concepts that came out of that was this project is exciting and innovative, and look at how much product we've got laying around out there that we could reduce fire with putting it through this way, even though it's not 500 tons is not a great amount, guys, not at all. But we then decided we need to form a co-op, and by May of 2015 we had the co-op formed. Many people have been involved in this. Senator Cliff Bentz has helped us along the way. We then were able to let the for-profit company build the system for us, and they are the ones that own the tax credits. The tax credits change, the EIPs change, and it's a 5-year payout. We went forward, we went online. It is fully functional and commissioned on October 28, 2016. The heating has been consistent. It's been wonderful. It's pumped underground. The pipe that we have is PEX pipe. It comes from Russia. It is good to 50 below outside. It's very expensive. It's top of the line. It does not fail. We put it in the ground to pump the water down to the courthouse, which was 6 blocks from us. There is a church that is coming on board. There's opportunity for expansion into housing developments. Anybody that's along that line could come into our system. But we just haven't been ready, and we can't interrupt the system until the summer. We purchased this system with the help of Craft 3. I can't say enough about Craft 3 because they don't just understand the lack of the ability to find a loan. They understand everything we needed. They told us you need an expansion line. You need the ability to pay your bills. Understand, guys, we had good sources of paying for the TESA, for the fuel costs, the thermal energy. What we didn't have is any money in the bank. We had none except for the bank worthiness of the county and of the school, which were the two primary people. And then we had a man named George Wilbur, who is a CPA there, that helped us with this, and it's been very, very good at helping us with every step of the way. We are able to expand, and that is what we need to do. Our capability is 6,500. You can call them BTUs, but they're thermal. They're hot water. We doubled the price of what we were going to require the county and the school to pay for that heat because we wanted to pay our bills from day one and not dip into anything. But our loan was structured that we had expand money. We had to cover bills. We had also to buy things and to do repairs. So we're sitting very comfortably, and the ability for those guys to understand what we needed and to tailor that to our fit. And again, it's a USDA guaranteed loan, which was wonderful for us. Maybe more interest than we wanted to pay, but, you know, we need to be solid for this to be real and to expand. And we think it can expand downtown. Harney County is hoping that we can put the money together to build new schools. We're hoping that we can pump that water to that new school, which will increase the ability for us to sell more. There is an infinite amount of fiber available. There is jobs that are being affected by what we're doing right now. There's an electrical company that we have a contract with. We still have a contract with a gentleman in Austria. There is no protection, no copyright on any of this equipment. If I had something I would love, it would be that we would build this boiler in Burns. Might be a little more practical in Portland. It would be a wonderful thing for all of the areas that do not have natural gas. Natural gas would be competitive with this, but still it would clean up the forests. We have capacity, so we're about 50%, selling about 50% of our fuel, of the available energy, which means we could really go downtown and do the whole corridor. We have to get the money together to do the expansion, and then we have to talk to the people about putting in the systems. The systems are very small. They're a little bit like the Mitsubishi that you see that hangs on walls, air conditioning, but it's ran hot water. It's 80-degree hot water is all you need to produce heat, and then there is a heat pump usually. The heating savings at the courthouse was 50%. That's with doubling the cost, 50%. Because if we get where we can sell all of our energy, we are going to reduce the cost to our customers.
Right. Well, I'm going to have to wrap it up. We move forward, but it's a great story. And I'm curious how you get your fuel stock.
How do we what?
Get your fuel stock, the wood, the fiber.
Well, we can buy it from pulp developers. There's stuff everywhere, but right now we're developing it out of the local garbage dump.
Really?
We do, because he doesn't have any way. I mean, that he doesn't want to burn it, mm-hmm. and he gets a ton of that debris. We also have some manufacturers that have byproducts of what they do in the woods industry mm-hmm. that would sell it. We're trying to go more into the things that they want to give it to us, because we are a nonprofit,
mm-hmm.
and it is donation. If we can get one-third of that, that, again, is going to lower that cost.
Yeah. From my past experience with the Public Utility Commission, when we were looking at a lot of the biomass, the basic problem that we always had trouble getting over is how do you get the fuel stock to the boiler cheaply enough to make it pencil?
We actually have our garbage owner, CNB, he does it by containers. Mm-hmm. He loads it and he delivers it. It's all automated. This whole system is 100% automatic through the computer. We can check it. I can check it on my computer or my iPad. Everything. The technology is much more advanced. The city in Austria that, and it's not just that city, all hot water, all heating water, and all electricity is through a boiler very similar to this, about 10 times bigger.
Wow. Other questions, committee? Well, it's a great project, and I understand, I think we understand the idea of the fund. That's something that I suspect we'll be talking about and considering for the 2019 session, obviously not this one, coming up a little early. And one of the things that the committee has been doing this interim is trying to better understand the state's economic development program through Business Oregon and how these things fit together. So thank you very much for bringing it to us. It's been a good presentation, and congratulations. Great project and great story.
Thank you so much for letting us do this, and we just hope that you'll hear that it's going to be expanding across Harney County.
And you gave part of that credit to Senator Bentz, huh?
It's a fact.
Actually, he knows a lot about the energy stuff in his practice. He's done a lot of that, I know.
And he knows a lot about Harney County and his family.
He does.
So
he has told me often. Having grown up there, yeah.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Patrick, any more on that? Or
I think
done?
We're ready to transition.
Transition to transportation? Okay, we will do that. Committee, the next work session is on transportation, and we have some of
Becky Steckler is here.
Great.
From your resort. So.
Thank you of all.
We are still dealing with technical difficulties, Mr. Chair. So we printed out her slides in a more readable than the six per page.
Okay.
Wait.
Thank you.
To do it. So our apologies on.
Sorry about that.
No problem at all. I think we can deal with it. Thank you so much for the opportunity to come today. Good morning, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. My name is Becky Steckler, and I am the program manager for Urbanism Next of the Sustainable Cities Initiative at the University of Oregon. I will obviously show you that I'm switching to the next slide. And so if you're not familiar with the Sustainable Cities Initiative, we kind of think of ourselves as an applied think tank for communities across the state that are grappling with sustainability issues. We do a lot of research, such as the project I'm going to talk about today. But we're probably the most well-known for the Sustainable Cities Year program, and that's where we really leverage the resources of the entire university, and we focus about 20 to 30 classes, so hundreds of students and thousands of hours with a community partner to really grapple with some of the issues that they're dealing with. We've done that here for the city of Salem and Albany and Gresham, Medford, many places around the state. This year, for the first time, we're working with an agency, and we're working with TriMet on the Southwest Corridor. We also have a program in China, and we do a number of trainings and other types of events. It's really fun for me to think about the future and how it's going to be different. And when you even when you look online for pictures of the future, they're often shiny and dark and fast. And I imagine there's a lot of architects with black turtlenecks wandering around. But I think it limits us. And really, somebody said, and I forget who they attributed it to, but the future is here now. It's just not evenly distributed. And so the future is going to look a lot more like Phoenix, Arizona, where today you could go and you could get a ride on a Waymo autonomous vehicle and go down Arizona streets. And really, it's kind of the point, a lot of these emerging technologies are getting integrated into the communities that are here right now. A lot of people ask, you know, how long is it going to take for this really to kind of hit the ground? Like, when do we plan for this? And there was a great graphic by the New York Times that showed that we are adopting these kinds of technologies at a faster and faster pace. It took about 100 years for the telephone to be in about 95 households across the country. It only took about 10 years for the cell phone to get to that same saturation point. And so, you know, we're seeing the adoption of these technologies when they're shown to be cost-effective and make our lives a little bit more convenient than people are really interested in being able to use them. So what I'm going to talk about today is autonomous vehicles, the sharing economy, and mostly thinking about rideshare, Uber and Lyft, those types of companies, but Airbnb, you know, bike share. There's definitely other types as well. And also a little bit about e-commerce, which I think you might be interested in. And what we see is that we're not so much interested in the technologies themselves, but really thinking about what are the secondary impacts, and how is this going to impact city form and city development? And there's quite a few. So just starting with e-commerce and some of the disruptions that are likely to bring. Just last year in 2017, over 7,000 stores, brick-and-mortar stores, closed, even though retail had increased by about 4% overall for the entire economy. A lot of those people are moving online and you know, purchasing. I think we've all probably ordered something from Amazon or from some other type of service. In the retail sector, they've seen about a 30% increase in bankruptcies, and there are additional stores that are opening, about 3,500 stores opened across the country, but a lot more of those were like bargain, bargain brands such as Dollar Tree and others like that. So it's definitely a shift in kind of how we are getting things. And so one of the questions we ask is, when you can buy anything anywhere, what happens to, you know, our downtowns and our commercial corridors? And what they're seeing in some of the trends, especially for retail, is that people want to go places where they're entertained. I've got a great picture of downtown Bend where people are standing in line for the Tower Theater. And so if they can be entertained, if they can be fed, actually the city manager for the city of Redmond said, thank God Oregonians really like their brew pubs because it's the one place they'll put their phone down and really talk to each other. We're also, like I said, changing how we're getting our goods. And I don't want you to be misled by the the name of our research, Urbanism Next, because these trends definitely have impacts on rural communities, not only in Oregon, but across the country. And so we're already seeing pushback from people that don't like so many delivery vans or delivery trucks in their neighborhoods. But when I was in, I got to go to Washington, D.C. Just back in September, and I saw a delivery drone, so a little box about the size of a cardboard box going down the street, and it was making a Chipotle delivery. And so, you know, it really, and as I'm watching this, being a land use planner, I'm like, what's it going to feel like when I'm walking down the street? And there's 10 of these going down. And how, how's that going to feel? And how is that service and that company going to help to pay for the infrastructure that they get to take advantage of? Parcel volumes have increased 50% between 2014 and 2016 globally. And these are trends that they're anticipating is definitely going to continue. One of the places that I think you're going to be very interested in is the impacts that these things have on tax revenues. I'm going to talk a little bit more also about just kind of what might happen with property values, but we definitely see some disruption in property values and the associated taxes with that. Also disruptions with employment and how people are employed, which have implications for income tax. And this might be one time when it's great not to be a sales tax state. The National Conference of State Legislators have estimated that other states are losing over $17 billion in tax income to e-commerce. So there's definitely, serious fiscal implications to these emerging technologies. Moving along in our thinking, actually, and the more we do the research, I kind of feel like autonomous vehicles are already here. They just happen to have drivers, and they tend to work for Uber and Lyft. And so a lot of the impacts that we're anticipating from AVs are really, are a lot of the ones that we are already seeing with ride-sharing companies. And you see those right now, it's really magnified in some of the much larger communities, but we just do have in some of the more urban locations, even in Oregon, felt some of these impacts. But definitely in San Francisco, studies have said that they estimate that 20% of the vehicle miles traveled now in San Francisco is from ride-sharing companies, and that it's an old statistic, but back in October 2016, over 60.
Say that number again.
Yeah, about 20% of the total vehicle miles traveled in San Francisco are estimated to be from ride-sharing companies.
So we're not far behind, Mr. Chair, if I may. I was at a Blazer game, and when we came out of the Blazer game, people were lined up waiting for their Lyft cars to pick them up.
Yep.
I mean, there was just a line of these cars coming in to pick people up at the Blazer game and take them home.
Yeah. There's other studies that say that about a quarter of the entire U.S. driving population would financially probably be better off if they just sold their cars today and exclusively used rideshare or other modes. So there's, if you live in a location that has those services, that it might really make sense if you drive less than 10,000 miles a year to use those services.
Makes sense.
Thinking about AVs, we really see that when they do hit the ground, that they're probably going to really magnify some of these disruptions and trends from both e-commerce and from the sharing economy. There's a real promise, and that's, I guess, what I really want to emphasize as well, is that there's a lot of challenges that they present, and there's a lot of opportunities, and I'm really excited to think about both of those. And one of those opportunities is to save over 37,000 lives that are people that are killed in auto crashes every year. But there's some real questions about, And policy, I think, is really going to help to define some of the key questions about how these technologies are deployed. And so one of those big kind of decision points is whether they're primarily going to be fleets that are owned by Ford or Uber or Lyft or Waymo, which is owned by Google, or if they're going to be individually owned like we have right now. And as you're thinking about the revenue that you get from registration fees, if they're fleets, there's a lot fewer cars out there, a lot fewer vehicles. So registration potentially goes down unless you increase the registration for that. There's also questions around whether the AVs are going to be electric or they're going to be gas operated. And again, as you're thinking about revenues from gas tax, what are the implications there and how do you replace those? Those are definitely some of the bigger challenges. AVs, another disruptor, is they're likely to be much less expensive to operate than conventional cars. It could be, you know, half the cost or even less. It might be free if you're in a Waymo vehicle and they're making their money by showing advertising around their vehicle. There's, and that has many implications as well, which I'm going to continue on. You know, a very simplified thinking about the economics of things that we want. As the price goes down, we tend to consume more of it. Down in UC Davis, they've done some really interesting behavioral studies, and they modeled, you know, what happens when you give a family, you know, basically an autonomous vehicle. They have a driver, and they you know, allow that family to be able to take that ride, you know, rides anywhere they wanted to at any time. And they found that when they did have that service and it was cheap or free, they made many more trips and they went many more miles. And that's really one of the big takeaways, is that vehicle miles traveled is, even for the preliminary modeling that's been done so far, is that it's going to be, it could increase dramatically. Some of the best modeling so far has been done by a company called Barron Peers. And in the presentation, there's the graphic there. So they've run a bunch of different scenarios, and they anticipate, you know, if there's no requirements for having shared vehicles, or even if you do require that about 50% of the shared vehicles, EMT still increases dramatically. The number of trips that are taken increases, and the average trip length might actually go down, because you might be taking many more shorter trips where you might have walked, or you might have biked. And so, kind of thinking about all those disruptions, what Urbanism Next is really thinking about, what are the implications for land use, transportation, urban design, and the real estate markets? And then what are the, of those changes, what are the implications for equity, for the environment, for the economy, and for governance? As a planner, you know, I think about a lot of the land use plans that we have, and we look at the past and how we've done things in the past, and then we forecast out in the future. We look at what's going to happen with the population, is it going to grow, what's going to happen with jobs, and then we kind of forecast out, and we make, you know, some changes around the edges. My studies in this have said the future is going to look nothing like the past, and so we really have to think about an entirely different framework, and that it's going to take a lot of people to understand what those challenges and opportunities are, to get together to think about, you know, how do you really respond to that? Starting off with land use, one of my favorite places to start is with parking. You know, our autonomous vehicles are not going to need to be parked in the same places where we want to park our cars right now. And autos are usually parked, all of our cars are parked right now. They're parked for about 95% of the time. But if you have an autonomous vehicle company, that car is moving a lot, and when you do need to go charge it or you need to do service or maintenance, it doesn't have to be, you know, in a downtown location or right here at the Capitol. You're probably going to go somewhere where, if it's electric, where you've got the access to utilities and it's closer to arterials or freeways, and where the land price is cheaper. And even where you do park that autonomous vehicle, you don't have to have a parking garage that allows room for people to get in and out of the cars. It doesn't have to have lighting. You can make it definitely much more efficient. Parking is one of these places, too, and I say, you know, one of the great opportunities, at least usually between 5 and 15% of land is dedicated to on- and off-street parking in cities, and I think that's a great opportunity for redevelopment, and also presents some additional types of challenges as well. I've got a picture of the city of Gresham. You know, your typical strip development might have 50% of the land zoned commercial but is dedicated to parking. I also wanted to think a little bit about housing. We're holding a conference in March. I'm going to tell you more about that at the very end. But there's a reason why our premier sponsor is Enterprise Community Partners, and they're probably the largest affordable housing organization across the country. And they definitely make they've made the connection between the importance of transportation to the affordability of housing, and they understand a lot of the related equity issues with these emerging technologies and with these concepts. You know, there's opportunities to be able to put more affordable housing in key locations that is parking right now, but then also just thinking about you know, where we will build affordable housing in the future and how that will be accessed by transportation is important to them. I also wanted to touch upon industrial use and our desire to have two-day or same-day delivery has been really increasing the demand and the cost for industrial land across the country. It's really been booming when you talk to the folks at the Urban Land Institute and the developers, and actually it's almost doubled the cost of much industrial land that's in close-in larger metropolitan areas. Because they're really looking for that, you know, location is really important to be able to have access to those customers. Another area thinking about, so that's primarily just some of the issues related to land use, and there's many others. And we're also thinking about urban design and actually how our cities are developed. The National Association of Realtors does a great survey of, you know, what are people looking for in housing, and about a third of the people that they survey say, you know, they want larger yards and they're willing to have a longer commute. And often what they say is that one of the reasons they don't want to live closer in is because they don't want to have to deal with parking. And so, you know, once they don't, there's a lot of questions and really, I think, a lot of disruptions when you don't have to deal with parking anymore. You know, is that going to change where they're going to want to live? But then also, if they can make their time more productive in an autonomous vehicle, they can work, they can binge watch Game of Thrones. You know, are they going to be willing to live even farther out? You know, am I going to pick up my family and move to Hood River because I can work in my autonomous vehicle to my job that's right in downtown Portland? You know, in Oregon, you know, we have urban growth boundaries that constrain some of that sprawl, but in almost all across the country, that is not the case. Yeah. And so you might see people that are, you know, the current modeling is that sprawl dramatically increases with autonomous vehicles on the ground. But it's not limited to the edges of our communities. Even the way that we design our streets is going to be impacted by autonomous vehicles. So street design, thinking about how these vehicles integrate with bicycles and with pedestrians, with transit, and thinking about they don't need as much space as human drivers do. You can put them much closer together. You can put them both front to back and on the sides. So there's the real potential to redesign our streets in ways that are much more effective. And so we anticipate that the way that our cities are designed are going to look much different in the future. There's also a number of course, impacts on transportation itself, and one of those, which I've alluded to already, is the impact on transit. Again, Fair and Pierce has done some preliminary modeling, and they have found that transit is impacted pretty negatively in most of the models that they run, and it could be 8 of the 9 models that they tested had a range of about a reduction in actual transit rides by about 12% to 43%. And so I don't know what transit agency can still operate if 43% of their riders go away. So there's some, and again, this is where policy, I think, is really important, because I have concerns about some of these, you know, if we privatize more of these services that have historically been offered by governmental agencies, you know, are they going to take care of some of our most vulnerable populations, make sure that they have access to transportation too? But there's opportunities there as well. So the transit service and the ability for it to keep up, I think, is really critical as well. I mentioned the street design and really thinking about that, but I want to say something a little bit more about curb management, which you've already talked about. Because if you've been to the airport or a major event, or you've picked up or dropped off kids at an elementary school at any time in the recent past, you know just how challenging it is to get a lot of cars in and out of a place when they want to have a drop-off or pickup. And now we're more likely to see that kind of congestion throughout metropolitan areas. You know, it's 5 o'clock and everybody wants to go home. You know, what happens to our city streets, and how do you find your Uber or Lyft when there's 75 of them lined up? And so curb management is something that a lot of cities are starting to pay much more attention to, and also thinking about pricing mechanisms to make it a much more efficient. And it really, I think, emphasizes, I look at the picture here, you know, the elementary school drop-off, and there's one lonely bus in the back. But it illustrates, you know, if all of those kids are, you know, if we're all taking transit, it's a much more efficient way to get people in and out. And so kind of the importance of, you know, efficiently moving people through our cities and our city environments. There's a great, I hope you are on the slide with the with the RPA, the Regional Planning Association, and the Roads to AVs. We don't know when exactly in every different location that, you know, that we will see autonomous vehicles on the ground, but I just feel like this is a great, you know, gives a good example of, you know, the types of changes we're likely to see in different phases. And one of the things that occurred to me, you know, I just started this job back in August, and before that I was tracking the transportation bill in the 2017 legislative session. And so most of that $5.3 billion that Oregonians are going to be spending on transportation is during that kind of phase one and phase two. And then right after that, it's likely that our needs and our transportation needs are going to look a lot different. So are we going to be investing those dollars wisely for a very different type of future? Cities are starting to tackle these issues and really think about them, but there's not one transportation plan that I've seen that has had the time to even think about integrating into their to the transportation plan and updating it to reflect these types of changes and really even think about these types of changes. And it's all pretty new. Finally, I just wanted to talk a little bit about some of the impacts on real estate. There's the saying, form follows function, but I think if you're a developer, what probably rings a little bit more true is form follows parking, and much of what you can do on a parcel is determined by how much parking you have to fit in and what kind of development you can put around it. And so the transportation experts and consultants that we talk to are advising their clients to really think about future-proofing their developments and to build as little parking as they are required to, and if they have to build a parking structure, to do it high floor to heights, high floor to height to ceiling heights,
convertible,
exactly, and flat slabs so that they can convert it to office use or residential use or some other use in the future, because if you're taking out a 30-year mortgage or a 30-year bond, they can't guarantee that they're going to have the revenues to pay that back over that 30-year period. And things get a little messy in the interim as, you know, as we transition from one kind of way of operating to a different way of operating. I want to now kind of switch from, you know, these are some of the big disruptions that we're likely to see, and that there's some very specific implications that it has for equity, for the environment and economy and governance. Really thinking about equity first, you know, there's a great opportunity to provide additional options for people and improve the access to transportation. You know, for folks that are transit dependent and live in places that are not easy to serve by transit, you know, microtransit potentially really opens up, you know, if they've got odd hours that, you know, don't work well with transit schedules. But again, as I said, there's some real challenges and some real concerns if that is provided by a private company, and are they really going to be serving the needs of those particular people? And I think there's an important role for government to ensure that all of those public goods are really, you know, and the different populations are protected. Also, I want to just emphasize that there's probably going to be some real changes in how people are employed. And, you know, this isn't about AI, but there's, you know, implications here as well. There is about, you know, 4 million drivers. There's a great NPR graphic that I've got in the presentation that's, you know, shows what the most common job is across the country, and usually it's drivers. And so what happens to these people when they can no longer be drivers, that you know, that is outsourced?
They'll all be delivering packages.
They are. Their drones are. It's hard to say. You know, along those lines, too, I've got a great map from the New York Times that just shows where you've seen the growth in e-commerce jobs. And it's not in smaller rural towns. It's really tends to cluster around populations of about 250,000 or more. So, you know, the distribution of these jobs is really changing as well. You know, we're also thinking about the implications for the environment. And so if, you know, without policy interventions and vehicle miles increasing, from AVs and even rideshare, then what happens to greenhouse gas emissions? And, you know, how are cities, you know, that have adopted climate action plans going to be able to, you know, achieve the goals that they have and that in those plans, you know, under this kind of, you know, disruption and change? And just with street design, there's probably some opportunities to really address stormwater management as well. I guess I come back to governance, and this is where I feel like I'm talking directly to you. You know, I want to emphasize AVs aren't a transportation issue, and e-commerce is not a retail issue. These are everything issues, and when you start, it feels like an onion, you start peeling off the layers, and you realize, oh, yeah, that's going to impact this and this other thing, and then down the road, this other thing, too. And it's going to take a lot of thinking about it and understanding what these challenges and opportunities are, and then it's going to take a lot of stakeholders to come to the table to understand what they're going to need to do. And what they're going to need to do is really think about the regulations and the policies that we have. And some places, I think, are doing a really good job at saying, you know, what are our community goals? What are our community values, and what do we want? And how do we make sure these emerging technologies really support those goals and don't undermine them? Some places around the country that we've talked to is like, we're just open for business, and we're going to do what we can just to allow it to happen, and then, you know, we'll see what happens from there. But I think it makes communities much more vulnerable to the challenges and unable to really take advantage of the opportunities. So there's probably going to be some needs for different regulations. Also, governments are going to have to think about what kinds of services and programs they offer and how that might need to change. But the real thing, too, is, you know, and just illustrating the challenges to transportation funding, you know, there's a real risk to how we fund transportation. I haven't even touched on parking revenues, which I will in a moment. But there's also that opportunity, if there's the political will, to also be able to address congestion through congestion or other types of pricing, you know, vehicle mile pricing as well. So there's opportunities there also. Just to illustrate kind of those implications for government as, you know, as governments are thinking about what types of projects and infrastructure they're bonding, the city of Sacramento is on the hook for about $626 million to finance the Golden One Center, which is where the Kings Arena is. And they're bonded out to 2050, so over a 35-year period. And they're depending on about 20% of the funds, or about $62 million of parking revenue to help pay that back. And, you know, based on the research I've seen, that's going to be really hard for them to do. Lastly, I just want to say, when it comes to, you know, to governments and the policies that you're adopting, the importance of data and making sure that you're not preempting locals from being able to collect the data that we need. And given the newness of this and how much data is being collected and the importance of being able to wisely use government resources, the billions of dollars we're investing in infrastructure and making sure that we're doing that in a wise and economical way, that data is really important. And so getting a good grip on the types of data that's needed and protecting privacy and a lot of those related issues. It's really complicated, but I think it's a path that that societies and communities are going to be much better off if they tackle and really think through. And I think some local governments are really starting to think about that right now. So data reciprocity, I think, is just really important. With that, Urbanism Next is thinking about all of these issues. We have a national network. We work with folks in both the public and private sector across the country, as well as academics. We meet regularly with agencies in the Portland metro area that are thinking about AV policies. We're doing a bunch of research around potential regulations, such as responsive parking regulations, thinking about you know, kind of that almost congestion pricing opportunity, and potentially, instead of treating roads as a public space that anyone has access to, what if we actually price them more like a utility that has limited capacity? We're also doing research around AVs and greenhouse gas emissions, and we're in discussions with the city of Gresham to actually look at all of the different city departments and think about how these emerging technologies are going to impact them, and what are the different options they have to really address that. And then we're also, wasn't on my list, but we're doing a bunch of work around the impacts on local and state budgets. We're doing a lot online, so you can always check in what we're doing on urbanismnext.com. And as I mentioned, we're having a conference where we're bringing national thinkers and leaders from across the country to Portland at the Oregon Convention Center from March 5th through 7th. And this would be a great event for you to attend or your staff if this has at all intrigued your interest. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Very thought-provoking. questions?
Yeah, I got one.
Yes.
Excuse me. The one slide that you had about the integration of AVs, that's one area that, as a legislator, we're very, very interested in because we need to get from point A to point B.
Right.
And there's going to be a lot of technology clashes going on when we try to make that, you know, try to switch over. So someday I'd like to see something really that goes into a lot finer detail as to how to convert from point A to point B. It's fun to look down the road. It really, I just get really excited. I won't be there, but I still get excited. But you have, like, you know, the grid. How are we going to, are these going to be on electrical grids? You have the potential of fusion coming on in 2040, you know, hydrogen technology. There's a lot of different technologies that are going to come into play.
Right.
But really the emphasis, at least for me, needs to be from point A to point B. So the next, you know, I think AVs will be around, I think it'll be a lot more common sight even within 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
2020, 2022, somewhere in there, I think you'll see the major manufacturers putting those out. But now, all of a sudden, you have, you know, if you get a string of AVs, they're going to be more like a train. How does that incorporate onto the highways? That sort of thing. So I really, we have to do a lot of thinking. Just, I love the long-term thinking, but I do think that we need to go into a lot greater detail into the next 10, 20 years so that we can do the conversion.
Absolutely, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. I think you're right. It feels like we ask one question, and then that generates about 20 or 30 more questions that need to be answered to be able to address the first one that you asked. You know, it's been really exciting for us. We've had a number of classes on the Southwest Corridor, some budgeting classes that have just looked at, you know, what happens to the fiscal implications for transportation for cities of Tigard, Tualatin, and City of Portland, and students just kind of playing around with some of those assumptions, and then where would it actually come from, and listening to their presentations, I'm like, oh my gosh, this, you know, it's complicated, and it's going to take a lot of people really hashing through all of those issues. And as you said, that the interim, you know, when you've got especially for AVs, and you've got you know, drivers on the road as well, you know, how they interact is potentially going to be kind of messy.
Just a skosh.
little things like electric cars, you know, not recognizing white trucks in front of them.
Yeah. Or even the example there was in Las Vegas, you might have seen there was a transit bus that was operating. And within the first hour of operating, it got into a crash, and it had stopped because there was a large truck, and the truck was backing up, you know, it was so slow motion that people inside are like, you know, if it was a driver, the driver would have honked its horn or would have backed up, but it was an autonomous vehicle. There was no way for the shuttle to do that. So, you know, so it just makes you realize all the different, you know, scenarios that have to either be played out or that have to be, you know, now I think they're going to be putting horns in their shuttles so that the concierge can honk it. So it's complicated.
I suspect that there's going to be a whole lot of engineers going, I never thought about that.
Yeah.
More?
No, I'm good.
Great presentation. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank
and
you.
Look forward to following your site and Your comments are not lost on me. We talked about that a lot as we were putting the transportation package together. I'm not sure we did a lot about it, but we talked about it a lot. And the other one, I'll tell you, they're having a discussion with the Port of Portland, the airport, and they're stuck with parking now, and their whole thing was, we don't think we should build another parking structure because we don't think it'll be around long enough to pay the debt off.
Right.
But what do you do in the interim?
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All righty.
Thank you.
We're now down to the last piece of our agenda, which is the traditional pre-session filing of bills. We have three of them. They are listed in a paper, and I would just, for the audience who aren't familiar with the process, when we introduce bills as committee bills, people voting to introduce the bill, that is not a commitment that they support or oppose in any way the bill. It's just a matter to move the process forward. So with that, I'm going to turn to my vice chair and say, would you like to offer a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move the following legislative concept drafts be introduced as committee measures, LC-233, dated December 14, 2017, LC-234, dated January 8, 2018, and LC-239, dated January 2, 2018.
The Vice Chair has moved LC-2033, LC-2034, LC-2039, be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion on that motion?
You need to do the disclaimer.
I just did before. No one do it again?
No, that's fine.
Once again, voting to move the bill in is not a commitment to vote for the bill as it moves ahead. It's just to get the process going forward.
Thank you.
Does that work?
That does.
Okay. Yeah, there are a couple here that you may have some concerns as we get into discussion, if we get them in this committee even. Discussion? Is there any opposition to the motion? There is none. The motion is adopted. The bills were introduced. And let's see. Patrick, I think that took us to the end of the day. Is that correct?
It does. It is, Mr. Chair. Just one note. Going into the February session, I will note that because we have a lot of committees and shifting staff, I will not be staffing this committee during the February session.
Mm-hmm. He's abandoning us.
So Kayla Byers is sitting in the front row. Kayla's on our staff. She's going to staff this. We have a team approach that we do with all of the business, transportation, economic development committees, and so I'll still be around and working with Kayla and Kayla working with me on that, but she will be the person day-to-day sitting at the dais on this committee during session.
So, Patrick, as I understand this, this is the next movement in LPRO, is that what we're calling it now,
yes,
to try to develop core professional groups,
correct,
much like we did LFL. And so if
that's
anybody
right,
objects to the process change, it's our fault. Thank you very much. Patrick, thank you for everything you've done for us, and I know that we'll be calling on you along with Kayla. So with that, anything else for the good of the order? None, we are adjourned.